Your headlines for this hour: Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says its retaliatory missile strikes against Israel will continue until the regime stops its policy of assassinating resistance leaders. Russia denies reports that Ukrainian forces have made breakthroughs along the front lines, saying such reports do not correspond to reality. Sudan's warring sides reach a preliminary agreement to reach civilians or protect civilians and facilitate humanitarian aid, but fall short of declaring a ceasefire. Thank you for joining us. Islamic Jihad says another of its commanders has been killed in a new Israeli airstrike on Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Resistance Movement confirmed the death of Ahmed Abu Daga. This after the head of Islamic Jihad's rocket launching unit, Ali Ghali, and two other commanders died in similar airstrikes on Khan Yunis. The regime has also targeted civilian buildings in Rafah, Khan Yunis, Beit Hanan, and other parts of the blockaded strip. Israel's attacks have killed 30 people so far, including women and children. Nearly 100 Palestinians have also been injured. Meanwhile, a top Israeli commander has called for ramping up attacks on Gaza to kill more Islamic Jihad fighters. More than 140 Palestinians, including women and children, have been killed by the regime so far this year. Palestinian resistance fighters continue retaliatory rocket strikes towards the occupied territories, including the cities of Tel Aviv and Ashkelon. The incessant Palestinian missile fire has sent Israeli settlers to shelters in towns close to Gaza. Israeli medical sources say a rocket fired from Gaza killed one person and injured over a dozen in the central city of Rehovot. The regime says over 800 missiles have so far been fired from Gaza. After more than a year of unrelenting Israeli violence that has killed over 140 Palestinians, the latest escalation has drawn international calls on Israel to stop its crimes. The regime has grown more violent since Benjamin Netanyahu returned to power late last year at the head of an extremist far-right coalition cabinet. Now, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says intense missile strikes by resistance groups against Israeli settlements and cities will not stop until regime's aggression stops. Anwar Abu Taha, spokesman for the movement, said Palestinian missile strikes will continue until Israel gives up its policy of assassinating resistance leaders. He added that intense missile response to Israel's aggression is meant to send a strong message to the regime. Abu Taha said the resistance has many of the surprises which can compel the enemy to stop its aggression against Palestinians. He said the assassination of Islamic Jihad's leaders cannot weaken the movement, whose missiles can now reach Tel Aviv and its suburbs. Hamas resistance movement, for its part, slammed the international silence towards Israel's aggression against Gaza, saying it only encourages the regime to intensify its crimes against Palestinians. Moreover, the Joint Operations Room of the Palestinian Resistance Factions said resistance groups will not back down in the face of Israel's assassination of their leaders.
Israel has kept pounding the Gaza Strip, targeting areas in the southern part of the besieged Palestinian territory. It came after the Israeli military conducted airstrikes against the Gaza Strip, assassinating senior Islamic Jihad officials.
The Israeli occupation committed a great crime and treacherous aggression against our people in the Gaza Strip by bombing residential areas and homes, which led to the killing of children and women and targeted the leaders of the resistance. Our people and the resistance know how to respond to this great crime and make the occupation pay the price for this aggression on the Gaza Strip.
Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza have fired rockets towards Israeli sites in retaliation for the regime's deadly air raids, hitting targets as far as Tel Aviv. Gaza's Joint Command of Palestinian Resistance Groups claimed responsibility for firing rockets at Israel, saying in a statement it had fired hundreds of rockets towards the occupied Palestinian territories, including Tel Aviv, in an operation codenamed Revenge of the Free. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh has warned that Israel will pay the price for the killings. The Palestinian resistance group Lion's Den has warned the Tel Aviv regime of surprise and unprecedented retaliatory attacks after the assassination of high-profile resistance commanders in Israeli airstrikes. Iran, Lebanon, Egypt, Jordan, amongst many Muslim countries, and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or the OIC, condemned in separate statements the Israeli aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip.
The fatalities from the Israeli airstrikes also include senior commanders of Islamic Jihad as well as their family members. The regime claims it targeted Islamic Jihad leaders and the resistance group's weapons.
High-profile commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad resistance movement have been assassinated after Israeli military aircraft launched a series of targeted strikes on the Gaza Strip days after a fiery flare-up of violence set the besieged coastal area on edge. Alongside the assassinations, military compounds and a military position belonging to the Islamic Jihad were targeted as well. The Islamic Jihad resistance commanders in the strikes include Khalil Bahitini, the commander of the Al-Quds Brigades in the northern Gaza Strip, Tariq Izzeddin, a spokesperson for the movement, and Jihad Al-Ghannam, secretary of the movement's military council. Bahitini was the most senior operational commander in the Islamic Jihad and was responsible for the rocket fire towards occupied territories in the past month. Izzeddin was responsible for the communications between the movement and its branches in the West Bank and for transferring funds and coordinating resistance active in the occupied lands. Ghannam was one of the most senior and veteran operatives in Islamic Jihad and served at one point as the commander of the Al-Quds Brigades in the southern Gaza Strip.
This enemy is a criminal entity ever since it was created on the land of Palestine. It assassinated leaders in their homes with their families and children. They did not assassinate them in the battlefield, not in the streets or cars. They assassinated them while they were with their children and killed their children and women along with them.
Meanwhile, Israeli troops have shot dead two young Palestinian men during a military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Kabatia, the latest in a year-long spike of violence that shows no sign of abating. The Israeli military said it conducted a raid in the early hours of Wednesday on Kabatia, situated 6 kilometers south of Jenin. The Palestinian Ministry of Health identified the victims as 19-year-old Ahmed Jamal Asif and 24-year-old Warani Walid Katanat. Another Palestinian was injured in the assault. Witnesses said a large number of Israeli forces raided Kabatia and broke into several homes in the western neighborhood of the West Bank city. They violently searched the buildings and ransacked all properties before leaving. The Israeli forces then closed the main streets in the town while laying siege to a number of houses. The regime has stepped up attacks across the occupied territories over the past months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank so far this year.
Khaled Qaddoumi, the representative of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas in Tehran, says the blood of all Palestinians who have lost their lives due to Israeli atrocities is sacred. He also urged the international community to take action to stop the regime's aggression.
It's not that the Israel are targeting somebody and they are saving some others. This is the narrative of Israel in order to create some disunity among the Palestinians. But actually, for us, in Palestine and in particular in resistance, we do not differentiate. It is a holy, sacred blood and sacrifice of our people, let it be from Jihad Islami, Fatah, Hamas, or anyone who is standing in front of the and confronting the Israeli atrocities, which been continuous since over a century now. What we are doing today is to tell the international community what you need is to do whatever you are saying to us. As we have heard from the report which you have just heard, that the international communities, the regional organizations has condemned the killing. The thing really which harmed me as a Palestinian, the time somebody using the passive verbs for verbs in condemnation of killing of our civilians. Who has killed them? They have to say that Israel is a murderer, Israel is a killer, and they have to carry their responsibility to take Israel to the court of judgment and justice. Today, our people, they have announced and declared that they are in the street to confront and defend themselves from Hamas, from Jihad Islami, or any other movements against the Israeli aggression and Israeli crimes.
Russia has denied reports that Ukrainian forces have made breakthroughs in various places along the front lines, saying such reports do not correspond to reality. The Defense Ministry's statement said the overall situation in the area of Russia's special military operation is under control. The ministry was reacting to online reports that claimed Ukrainian forces had made advances north and south of the city of Bakhmut. They suggested that a long-awaited counteroffensive by Ukraine has started. Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky has said that Kiev needs more time before beginning a counteroffensive against Russian forces with the help of its Western supporters. Zelensky said his forces were mentally ready, but in terms of equipment, not everything the Western countries promised has arrived yet. Talks between Sudan's warring sides to reach a truce has reportedly made some headway. The Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces have reached a deal to protect civilians and the movement of humanitarian aid. The army and the RSF signed a preliminary agreement in the Saudi city of Jeddah after days of wrangling. A U.S. State Department official said the agreement, however, falls short of declaring a ceasefire on which the two sides remain far apart. The unnamed official added that negotiators have set a goal of reaching a ceasefire deal in up to 10 days. The declaration signed early Friday seeks to improve the flow of humanitarian relief and begin restoration of water and electricity services. The UN says more than 600 people have been killed and more than 5,000 injured in Sudan fighting. In addition, 700,000 people have been displaced inside the country, while 150,000 have fled to neighboring states. A new survey shows 2 out of every 3 young women in Britain have faced sexual harassment, bullying, or verbal abuse in the workplace. The survey was carried out by the UK's umbrella labour organisation, the Trades Union Congress. It says most sexual abuse victims do not report incidents for fear of not being believed or losing their jobs. The study, which covered 1,000 women, said 3 out of every 5 women reported such incidents at work. However, the figure climbed to 2/3 amongst those aged between 25 and 34. It found that most abuse cases occurred on work premises, and rather than being isolated incidents, they were often repeated. The results also showed that fewer than 1 in every 3 women who experienced sexual harassment informed their employers. Pakistan's Supreme Court has declared the detention of former Premier Imran Khan as illegal, ordering his release. This follows days of violent protests in the country that left a number of people dead. Nasser Kazmi has more in this report.
Pakistan's Supreme Court has ruled that the arrest of the former Prime Minister Imran Khan was illegal, ordering his immediate release and asking the government to ensure his security. The court also urged the ex-premier to condemn the violent protests and emphasized that court's primary responsibility is to protect the citizens of the country. The country's top judge in his short verdict said that Khan would be kept in the police headquarters till his next appearance before the High Court on Friday over safety concerns. Khan was arrested by Pakistan's security forces on Tuesday over corruption allegations. The ruling Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz has criticized the country's Supreme Court for setting Imran Khan free. calling him a criminal.
The Supreme Court has double standards toward the government and Imran Khan. It has ruled that Khan, who is accused of corruption, should be provided with all facilities and be able to meet people freely. It would send a message that the courts are willing to compromise on justice. My only question is why the court has double standard.
The angry supporters of Imran Khan welcomed the Supreme Court decision, saying the release of their leader actually upholds the rule of law in the country.
Supreme Court of Pakistan ka shukr ada.
We are thankful to the Supreme Court for releasing Imran Khan from illegal detention by the government. The recent verdict of the top court will be considered as the supremacy of the rule of law in the country, which was violated by the current regime.
After being released by the court, the former PM expressed his grievances about his arrest, stating that he was abducted illegally and tortured during custody. Khan urged followers of his party to end their protests and refrain from damaging public and private property. Pakistan remains in the grip of deadly violence and protests after the arrest of the ex-premier.
Although the former Pakistani premier can now breathe a sigh of relief following the top court's decision, experts believe that Imran Khan has to prepare himself for more political challenges in coming days. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The 34th edition of Tehran International Book Fair is underway, which has brought together international and Iranian publishers. Salman Kujuri reports.
The 4th Tehran International Book Fair has opened in the Iranian capital. Some 2,700 domestic publishers and 100 foreign publishers from over 40 countries have attended this fair this year. The motto of this year's book fair is, "The future is worth reading." The international section of the fair aims to introduce the capacities of the publishing industry of the Islamic Republic of Iran to expand cultural exchanges in the international scene to lay the groundwork for communication between Iranian and foreign publishers. For the first time, bookstore owners can participate in the exhibition, and 200 have registered to compete with publishers in the virtual exhibition.
As you know, that Tehran Book Fair, one of the most important book fairs, that's Oman, Sultanate of Oman, that's need, that's should be that participate. You know, as you know, that's more that's visit to the book fair. And as you know, that's one of the most important, that's to participate. The relationship between Oman and Iran, that's most important and large. So that's from many years, that's about the relations.
For the second time, a virtual exhibition has also been launched to make books available to book enthusiasts. As usual, the books are available to the public at a discount. The rate of discount is 10% for the virtual exhibition and can be as high as 20% if you visit the fair in person.
The Tehran Book Fair provides a good opportunity for international visitors, book lovers, publishers, distributors, and retailers to meet and do business and at the same time exchange culture during the 10-day event. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The Zionist regime military has recently killed 13 Palestinians in overnight Gaza raids. The airstrikes targeted Islamic Jihad leaders, leaving three commanders killed, along with four children, three women, and a dentist. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, the Israeli regime military killed 13 Palestinians, including three Palestinian Islamic Jihad commanders, along with their wives and children, in an overnight attack on the Gaza Strip. A total of 40 fighter jets participated in bombing different locations in the besieged enclave just after 2 a.m. local time, according to the Israeli regime military. The Palestinian Health Ministry said four children, four women, and a dentist were among those killed. Another 20 people were wounded, including three children and seven women, some of whom are in serious and critical condition. Three commanders in the Al-Quds Brigades, the military branch of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, were killed along with their families in the bombardment. They were identified by the PIJ as Jihad Qanam, Al-Quds Brigade's General Secretary, Khalil al-Bahtini, a northern Gaza commander, and Tariq Ezzeddin, a military commander. The Islamic Jihad is considered the second largest armed group in the Gaza Strip behind Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement, which governs the enclave. The group said in a statement that a response to the Zionist regime aggression will not take long. The bombardment will be met by the bombardment and the attack will be met by an attack, said Islamic Jihad spokesperson Talekh Salimi, adding, this crime of the Zionist regime will not pass unpunished. Hamas chief Ismail Haniyeh said, assassination of leaders will not bring the occupation security, but more resistance. The Zionist regime war minister Yoav Gallant said, the military, working with Shin Bet intelligence service, targeted the leadership of Islamic Jihad in Gaza in a precise operation. Shortly after the airstrikes, the Zionist regime military acknowledged the attack, which it called Operation Shield and Arrow. Bracing for rocket fire from Palestinian groups, Israeli cities near the frontier with Gaza opened public bomb shelters. Roads near Gaza and beaches in southern Israeli cities of Ashkelon and Ashdod have been closed. In a brief statement, the Palestinian Health Ministry mourned the Zionist regime killing of Jamal Khashwan, a well-known dentist and the chairman of Al Wafa Hospital's board of directors. He was killed with his wife, Merfat Khashwan, and their child, Yusuf Khashwan. The statement of the Palestinian Health Ministry said the Ministry of Health mourns with great sadness Dr. Jamal Khashwan, who was martyred at dawn today, alongside his wife and son, as a result of the brutal Zionist attack on Gaza City, adding, Dr. Khashwan was a man of great patriotic and medical dedication. An Israeli regime military spokesperson said they were aware of some collateral but had no immediate comment. The attack comes a week after a brief exchange of fire between the Zionist regime and Palestinian groups in Gaza left one Palestinian killed and two Israelis wounded. It followed the death of prominent Palestinian hunger striker Khadr Adnan, who was a member of the Islamic Jihad in the occupied West Bank. The recent airstrikes were the largest attack mounted by the fabricated regime of Israel against Gaza since August last year, when the military assassinated senior PIJ commander Taysir al-Jabari, triggering a three-day exchange of fire. At least 49 Palestinians were killed in 2022 Israeli regime bombardment, including 17 children and 360 others wounded. More than 2 million Palestinians are packed into Gaza, an area the size of U.S. city of Detroit. Under the blockade by the Zionist regime since 2006, the besieged coastal enclave has been described as the world's largest open-air prison. The Zionist regime withdrew its troops from the Strip in 2005 but maintains tight control of Gaza's airspace and land and sea borders, which has reduced its economy to a state of collapse. According to Wafa News Agency, the Palestinian presidency has recently condemned the Zionist regime's escalation in the aggression against the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. We condemn this dangerous Israeli escalation against our people, which targeted children, women, and homes in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including Al-Quds, the latest of which was the killing of 13 civilians, including women and children in the Gaza Strip, and the injury of 13 people from bullets in Nablus, in addition to the ongoing storming of Al-Aqsa Mosque, said the official presidential spokesperson Nabil Abu Rodeine. He said, we hold the Israeli regime fully responsible for this dangerous escalation that drags the region into a scour of violence, tension, and instability. Abu Rodeine warned the U.S. administration against allowing the Zionist regime to persist in its continuous crimes against the Palestinian people, especially as they affect children, women, and sanctities.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
The
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I am Asma. I have the pleasure to be your host for today's episode. And here with me, I have Sister Zainab. Welcome to your studio, sister.
Assalamu alaikum to you and all dear listeners. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and it's always a pleasure to be here with you because I'm pretty much sure that we're going to have such a beautiful discussion about everything that is related to Muslim ladies. Just to start the discussion, I would add it this way, that women have come a long way since they started joining the workforce in large numbers in the late 19th century. At first, how the story began was that they started to be workers and laborers because of that industrial revolution and whatsoever. And the lack of laborers that they had, women started to come and lend helping hand to all the men out there. So at the first place, it did not have such a prestige for a woman. It was just for the lack of, insurance, money, whatever, things like that. It was not a matter of prestige or anything that would add to your independence. But little by little, as we went further, the story changed and women started to become independent creatures for themselves. Like they started to be doctors, they started to have great responsibilities in society and policy. Whatever, now you can see that women have got a great role in their societies and wherever they are. So now the question is that, can women go for all the jobs they love?
They can, provided the jobs they love do not interfere with their modesty, chastity, with their Islamic dress code, overall with their inward and outward modesty. The question which is over here, that can they go for all the jobs that men go for?
Yeah.
It's more important.
Considering their natures.
Yeah. Because of their unique physical capabilities or the capacities they have, women are excluded from some of the jobs just because that does not endanger their health.
Yeah, so I guess it's safer to say that nature has restricted them from going for all the jobs that they might wish to go for.
Yeah.
Like, for example, a woman cannot be a miner.
Exactly, but see...
It would be a drudgery for her.
Yeah, in fact, there's one of the countries that strictly has strict laws for women miners, and that's China.
Yeah.
And China prevents women from mining. In fact, China Mining and Technology University has male-only entrance exams policy because according to the labor laws of China, mining is considered to be unsuitable for women.
Yeah, for her health, of course.
Yeah, so it's not just for health. There are so many things. Like, there are some things some governments have really realized that this does not suit a woman.
Yeah.
So realizing her anatomy, realizing her nature, realizing her being a soft creature. So there are some countries in the world that have really realized that women should be abandoned from this kind of
labor. Some special difficult jobs.
Yeah, and I agree with some of them. I won't say all of them, all of the countries where they actually restrict a woman from doing particular kinds of jobs. So there are some emotional things. Women is restricted from a job, and there are some physical things. So coming back to physical capacities, a woman is restricted from many of the jobs, and I think it's an honor to her if she's restricted over here, because there is this kind of slogan, gender equality or gender justice, which is even as per the Supreme Leader, which is a slogan to use women as a another,
for their benefit, of course.
For their benefit.
It's not for the benefit of women. It's for the benefit of societies and their policies.
Yeah, so they. Slogans are very different, but there are some countries seriously who have, realizing the physical capability of a woman, they restrict her from certain jobs. Like, for example, I'll give an example of Argentina. Women are not legally allowed to polish glasses.
To clean the glasses.
Yeah, and exactly, just because they have a softer physical anatomy, they get hurt easily. In fact, you may see, I was just going through some of the videos on social media where I saw like a woman just cutting the potatoes and her finger getting, you know, injured. And at the same time, man doing the same thing. And when a woman does that, she cries a lot. And even if a man gets hurt, he does not cry himself. The woman starts crying.
Yeah, because of her nature again.
Yeah, it was a funny video, but that has some reality in it. Yeah, woman has that kind of nature. So if she gets hurt physically, she can't bear the pain so easily and as the men can.
So this was just the beginning of the topic. We just opened up this box of worms and then we'd go for a break. After that, we'll catch up the rest of the story. Muslim ladies, this is your own program, and Sister Zainab and I are talking about jobs, the nature of women, and can they go for all different sorts of jobs, like, I don't know, mining, or I also have seen a documentary on women, on different jobs that women got, and then one of them was very strange to me. This woman was a truck driver. You know, considering the nature of a woman, that seems to be, you know, strange, sort of nothing that you have seen always in front of you. So, and then I thought, okay, maybe she is in need of that job, right? But again, what would happen to her nature? If we as society did not consider her nature, what is going to happen to these women? And right now there are going to be a large number, not just one, two, or three. There are these women that are actually wishing to go for strange jobs, which is not going to be good for their health. And at the same time, it's going to be very difficult for them. So now I would love to know, is there any other country that would restrict women from special jobs for the benefit of women in the name of women?
Like we were talking about, depending on their physical capabilities, some countries have really realized that women not to be doing certain kinds of jobs. We have Belarusian women can't drive buses that has more than 14 passengers.
Oh.
We do have women as bus drivers in India too. But this country, Belarusian, does not allow women to drive a bus that has more than 14 passengers. And I realized this, the reason behind this, when my sister got a car and she started, and my mother said, like, can you tell her just to drop us here, drop us there? And then I asked her, why don't you drop them here and there? She said, like, I can drop them here and there just once a day or twice a day, not all the time. I can't be driver all the time because whenever all the people who are staying in my car, I feel like all the pressure is on my arms. Then I had to talk to my mother again, and I told her, you realize.
So it's a mental pressure.
Yeah, I told her it's not just physical pressure on her, it's a mental pressure. So, like, do not go out whenever it's unnecessary. So now it was just a family thing, you know. In family, you have comfortable car, you have comfortable things. But when you are, as a woman or a bus driver, just imagine why women go for jobs, actually, in general jobs. Why do they go for jobs?
Well, general jobs, we could say that, okay, she wants to be independent and she wants to build an empire of her own.
Yeah, and there are some many other reasons. We can actually analyze them in future sessions, I guess.
So as you said, there are many countries that have restriction for the choice of job for women. And that was interesting because I didn't think that there is such a thing, such a restriction in countries for women to go for special jobs.
Exactly. There are some countries who have realized those, you know, the honor of women in terms of her physical health. I won't say they definitely realized her dignity and status like Islam does. Islam considers her as a human being. So we are not actually touching on Islam yet. But there are some countries just looking at her physical anatomy, they are restricting her from certain jobs. We said like in Argentina, they don't allow her to go for glass polishing. We said in China, they don't allow her to go for mining. Yeah, and there's another country, Guinea, that prevents women from working with certain types of hammers. So there are certain kinds of hammers which are really heavy, which are not... But look at some countries which are actually, or some governments which are encouraging women to go for weightlifting.
Mm-hmm.
And look at these countries who are realizing the anatomy of women and telling her you're not legally allowed to work mm-hmm. with these kinds of tools, like some kinds of special hammers.
Now, this is a very interesting topic to think about. I would love all you women out there to think about it, really, why certain jobs are very difficult, yet some special women, I would say special women, are attracted to those sort of jobs. There are, of course, many reasons, and in following sessions we might go for them. But right now, as we're finishing today's episode, let's go for a break, and then after that, we would have a wrapping up of whatever we have said up until now.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Yeah, women are delicate creatures and they must go for jobs according to their nature. This is, I guess, the main factor that we should consider whenever we are going to, I don't know, nurture our girls or maybe get attracted to a certain job or go for a certain job and these sort of things. So we were talking about the countries that have got some restriction laws for women to go for special jobs.
Yeah, and I kind of agree with them in certain cases, but definitely maybe not all. But yeah, realizing the physical anatomy of a woman, realizing the physical capabilities of a woman and not allowing her to do some particular jobs, I think I do agree to a greater deal with them. Yeah, sometimes some women love to be just because they are adventurous. But in general, because we are talking in general about women, we are not, whatever we have been talking about, we are talking in general. Like, not all women are like that. Their body features, their physical capabilities do not allow them to be like that. So, yeah, Russia does not have truckers in women. And there are 400 plus jobs in Russia that women are restricted from doing. 400 plus jobs. Like,
wow.
But Russia is actually having a deeper look into the women and anatomy honor. Like China said, it's not in the honor of a woman to be a miner.
Exactly.
Okay. And even in India, we have like, you know, if you're just going through, you have small girls who clean your car glass and you just pay them for this. In a similar way, France bars women from labor activities that involve carrying loads heavier than 55 pounds.
Yeah.
So we have seen
this
some...
This one is also good.
Yeah. We have seen some of the countries, like, you know, they have something in common. Do not give heavy loads to women.
Exactly.
And this, again, reminds me of, you know, Imam Ali al-Islam's letter number 31 says in Nahjul Balagha that women are like flowers. They're not servants.
Wow, such a deep and beautiful thing. Now I'm just thinking about what you said, and it's very nice. Exactly, that's the way I imagine a woman. She's a delicate thing, just like a flower, and you cannot take this flower into the desert and then expect her to be just a beautiful, flourishing flower. So, yeah, women must take care of themselves, I guess, at the very first step by themselves. And then society has to go for laws protecting women from getting heavy loads. And these heavy loads, you can take it as ironically, because sometimes you don't give them heavy loads as in you give them, I don't know, wood or anything else to carry, but it's a mental load that you're giving them, which is going to be a great pressure for a woman to take in. So thank you, sister. And thank you, dear listeners. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Until another episode, I just bid you farewell. May Allah protect you and shower you with His blessings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for
for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
African Americans make up about 14% of America's population of 332 million. Almost a third of prisons across the United States are filled with African Americans. According to human rights activists, black people are the biggest systematic victims of police brutality in the United States. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. At the end of a historic two-week tour of the United States, a United Nations mission has concluded that the country must move beyond piecemeal reform and slogan-making and tackle the ongoing scourge of police brutality and law enforcement's discrimination against African Americans. United Nations experts completed their first official visit to the United States as part of a system of global inquiries set up by Human Rights Council after the police murder of George Floyd in May of 2020. As they ended their tour of the United States on Friday, 5th of May, in Washington, D.C., the United Nations experts called for a nationwide commitment to address discrimination suffered by black Americans in their daily dealings with law enforcement. Dr. Tracy Kissi, one of two independent UN experts who conducted the visit, said, "In the United States, racial inequity dates back to the very creation of this country, and there are no quick fixes." Dr. Tracy Kissi added, "To this day, racial discrimination permeates through encounters with law enforcement, from first contact, arrest, detention, sentencing, and disenfranchisement." Dr. Kissi said, "What was needed was a whole government approach," adding, "This needs to be more than a slogan, and calls for reform." In the course of their 15-day mission, Dr. Tracy Kissi and Juan Menendez of Argentina visited six U.S. cities: Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Georgia, Los Angeles, California, Chicago, Illinois, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and New York. Their mission was to investigate excessive use of force, militarized policing, racial profiling, and other human rights violations by law enforcement and penal agencies against Black Americans. As they crisscrossed the country, the United Nations experts had emotional encounters with families of the victims of police killings and brutality and other law enforcement abuses. In Minneapolis, Minnesota, where a white police officer murdered George Floyd on 25th of May 2020, the panel spent time with the mothers of Philando Castile and Amir Locke, who were also killed by law enforcement in Minneapolis. Presenting their preliminary findings, Dr. Tracy Kissie said they had witnessed a pattern that could be traced to what she called the deep intrinsic legacy of slavery and legalized discrimination. She said that across the country, there remained a lack of awareness and acknowledgement of the extent to which racial inequities were still prevalent in the United States. The United Nations experts said the result was a culminating exhaustion in the Black community. Juan Mendez of Argentina, a former United Nations Special Rapporteur on torture, said he had been moved throughout the visit by the harrowing pain of victims and their families and the resounding calls for accountability. Juan Mendez said, "We support those calls for accountability." He was heartened by successful prosecutions of police officers involved in high-profile killings, such as those of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky. However, many more cases remained unresolved, suggesting a continuing degree of impunity. Juan Mendez added that their mission would be calling on U.S. Justice Department to make more serious and proactive use of its power through consent decrees to intervene in the inner workings of local police departments to address some of the most egregious abuses. Mendez said, "More robust government action is needed." The United Nations experts will present their final report to the Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland in September or October of this year. They indicated that among the demands they are likely to make is a call for better nationwide data and record and record keeping. Juan Mendez said, in the absence of a national database, police officers who had complaints of misconduct or excessive use of force filed against them were allowed to continue serving, in some cases going on to be involved in killings of African Americans. He added, the mechanism also received allegations of police officers who were previously guilty and or disciplined for misconduct, afterwards being hired by a different police department. Among other likely demands signaled by the United Nations experts were, one, a call for an end to racial profiling in policing in America. 2. A dramatic reduction in the use of solitary confinement in U.S. jails and prisons. And a total abolition of isolated incarceration for children under the age of 18. 3. Passage of George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which tackles racial bias and excessive use of force by law enforcement, but which has stalled in Congress. 4. An end to stereotyping of Black women and girls as angry and aged up. 5. Rooting out of white supremacist law enforcement officers to ensure that they no longer wear a police badge. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. Activists have urged California State to provide millions of dollars in compensation to Black American citizens as a means of apologizing for slavery and past injustices, rejecting the State Reparations Task Force proposal as inadequate. The 9-member reparations task force established through the state laws endorsed by Governor Gavin Newsom of the Democratic Party in 2020 has spent over 12 months on research while hosting sessions to listen to the public across California. Their efforts have culminated in a comprehensive plan on how to address various instances of racist injustices through restitution. The panel was receiving final feedback from citizens on Saturday, 6th of May, while examining ultimate proposals to present to the California Assembly, which will subsequently determine whether to execute the actions and forward them to Gavin Newsom's office for endorsement. The latest proposal came out recently suggesting a total amount of $1.2 million per person based on the average life expectancy. The estimates include a loss of $2,352 for every individual annually who resides in California due to excessive policing in black communities, a loss of $3,366 per individual annually for biased lending and zoning, a loss of $13,619 per individual annually for unfairness and prejudice in healthcare, and a loss of $77,000 per individual due to the devaluation and loss of black-owned businesses. Meanwhile, activists present at the gathering dismissed the current plan as insufficient. San Francisco is considering its own compensation plans at the community level, which consists of a suggestion to distribute $5 million to eligible black inhabitants. The report did not specify the expenses incurred by the state, but according to economists' approximations in March, the overall expenses due to the negative effects of housing and mass imprisonment could exceed $800 billion. In addition to monetary considerations, the task force suggests a number of policy modifications to address racial bias, including an official apology from the California legislature and from the governor of California for past instances of slavery and anti-black racism. A nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California report revealed that in California, black families earn 60 cents for every dollar earned by white families. Nearly 6.5% of California residents, roughly 2.5 million people, identify as black or African American. Other cities across the United States have also moved forward with reparations proposals. Authorities in Evanston, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago, authorized $10 million in reparations as housing allowances in 2021. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors has also expressed support for reparations that could offer several million dollars.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.